Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
He's a legendary designer, the man known for creating Apple's first store design back in 2001, and he worked with Steve Jobs to raise Apple's profile in retail. He's a founder and CEO of 8 Inc. 8 Inc. is a strategic design firm which has worked with Nike, Coke, Citibank, Virgin Airways, to name a few clients here in Singapore. They've worked with Singtel and Temasek. Tim Kobe is our guest today. He's written a great book, Return on Experience. If you're in the industry and you want to deep dive into how a leading figure in the industry thinks through everything from AI's impact on design to, you know, disruption of the future, this is the book to pick up. Welcome, Tim Kobe. Good evening over in San Francisco.
Hi, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, you've developed so many projects since Apple, but Tim, it's probably one of the projects you're best known for. So can you take us back to what that initial creative vision was all about? You know, was what you and Steve Jobs had in mind pretty close to what we see now when we walk into an Apple store today?
Well, we started on the program, many years ago. I think we probably started in 1998. But the key point there is that the white paper that I worked on basically outlined the logic behind why Apple should do a retail program. And it had to do with being much closer to their customers and controlling that conversation. And so from that standpoint, it really hasn't changed. We've gone through five different design iterations over the years. So, it's been essentially the first store opened 2001. So it's been almost 20 years. So, of course, in retail, you have to evolve on a regular basis, but I think it's been the best expression of the Apple brand values that we could create, and so we've been fortunate that it's been so successful.
The Apple store on Fifth Avenue in New York, I learned from your book, has the highest sales per square foot in the industry, $4,551. It also breaks many rules of the retail trade. So did you set out to break the rules when you were designing that store?
Not necessarily set out to break the rules. I think we set out to be as close to defining the values that Apple stood for. And, and as a sort of a disruptive brand in those days, it definitely wanted to position itself unlike the competition. In the book, we talk about this idea of beware of best practice. And a lot of that has to do with looking at points where you can differentiate your product, differentiate what makes you different from your competitors so you don't commoditize what it is that you offer.
You come back to this point of values pretty often. How did you decide on how to align the Apple Store, the look of, and feel of the experience in the Apple Store with the values of the company?
Well, so when we think of creating value for any company, it doesn't matter if it's Virgin or Apple or Tesla, any of those, the first thing we look at are what are the human outcomes. For you to be a successful company, you have to make things that other people value, that other people want or want to be part of. And so it's very important to set the human outcomes as your highest strategic level. And from there, you then develop a strategy that will deliver those outcomes. So there are many different ways, different types of touch points that you can create. But ultimately, what you need to do is to form a strategy that delivers the outcomes. And then from there, you then construct the tactics that deliver the strategy. And I think a lot of companies get caught up in the tactics and don't really start with the outcomes. And therefore, they have a lower probability of being able to be relevant to the people they're trying to connect with.
So in terms of outcomes, we're in this data world now. To what extent does research inform the sense of the outcomes that you're heading for?
Well, I guess, maybe Steve didn't necessarily believe a lot in research just because it was only half of the conversation. You know, it was looking backwards at stuff that already exists. Mm-hmm. What we also have to look at is looking forward. What are new things that could exist that actually would be better for people? And so, I think research is one important part, but ultimately what's interesting about data is you have the opportunity to maintain a dialogue with people today. And so what you're learning from them at any given time can help you improve your product and improve your relationship with your customers. So if you think of the most receptors that a brand has in the market, you're going to be able to derive the majority of successful information to help refine your product. And, you know, think of Google. Every time you do a Google search, Google gets smarter. And so the ability for that to inform how you improve your product becomes a competitive advantage.
All right. Coming back to Apple, you mentioned, you know, you authored that white paper spearheading Apple's personification in retail, so to speak. So why did you think then that Apple should have its own retail flagship program when back then it had only 2% of market share?
Yeah, well, primarily it struggled being represented by third parties. If you think about it, the automobile industry is probably the last surviving industry where the original manufacturer doesn't control the relationship with their customers. And so in the days when we started with Apple, much of the advertising that they would spend would drive customers to the store. But imagine the customers coming in interested in Apple, but because of either better margins or better incentives, they steer the customer to a different product. So Apple never had a chance to control the conversation. Therefore, it was very difficult to describe why they were a better, more competitive product. And they didn't really have any leverage in that conversation. And so it was critical. We had done work with Nike and the North Face prior to Apple, and the white paper was really recognizing that shift that was going on across many industries where the original manufacturer was looking to control that conversation.
There's a part in your book, Return on Experience, where you talk about an incredible interviewing process that you have to go through in order to work with Steve Jobs. What was he like to work with every day? You worked with him for what, every day for about 12 years?
Well, we met with him every Tuesday for about 12 years. Certainly not every day. I don't think either one of us would have survived. With him, you know, it was obviously we didn't know that it would be such a limited time, relatively speaking, you know, given his passing. But, you know, we learned so much from the interactions with him. And I think one of the most important parts is the recognition that there's, in many cases, there's a logical way of looking at the problem. Mm-hmm. And most companies tend to focus on logic and have that be the primary driver. Well, Steve would look at every problem from both a logical perspective as well as an intuitive perspective. And if you think, you know, he's notoriously, it's commonly held that he was difficult to work with. Mm-hmm. It was difficult because you had to have that flexibility of being able to work under a logic framework. And then if the logic worked out, still solve the intuitive part. And the intuitive part was really his interpretation of the customer experience. Mm-hmm. And so I saw him many times trust his gut over his brain, if you will, in terms of making a decision that he felt right versus what the conventional wisdom may have told him.
That's just fascinating insight into how Steve Jobs thought, using both sides of the brain, so to speak. Can you give us a sense of, you know, his intuitive decision-making when it came to what he really held as, you know, important for customer experience? What was he really firm about that he wouldn't give on, you know, when it came to disputes?
Well, I think, you know, with him, and I think it's true, I didn't work with him at Pixar, but I think with both companies, both Apple and Pixar, you know, there were times where he would go a long ways down a particular train of thought and then stop the project, step back, and, you know, say it still doesn't feel right, let's start again. And basically be comfortable with shifting the focus or being able to maybe take a different risk, particularly if it led us down a path that would be similar to his peers or similar to competitive companies. So, you know, I think that is probably, you know, one of the interesting parts that that he consistently displayed was the ability to focus really hard on getting it as right as he could.
All right. And speaking of getting it right, there's a great question in your book, Return on Experience, that I'll just raise here. What, Tim, are some of the most prominent challenges that designers face when trying to create new ways for companies to engage with their customers?
Well, I think we tend to, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, we tend to commoditize what we offer. If you look at the majority of CEOs, you know, I think there's some research that's pointed out in the book, but, you know, 80% of CEOs that they believe they're creating a differentiated product. Mm. Unfortunately, in the research, 8% of customers believe that. So there's a huge disconnect. And part of the reason is they may spend a lot of time creating something that's new and different and unique, but then when they get ready to turn it to the customer, to make the touch points that actually engage the customer, they look at their peers and they deliver the experience that people have with the brand in the same way as their peers. And ultimately what you're doing is you're commoditizing the product you make to be just about price or features and benefits, as opposed to leveraging the brand value potential that's there. And if you look at what many people think of with Apple, there's something we call an irrational loyalty. You're creating something more powerful than the logic side of the brain, which is really where all purchase and all participation in people's minds begins. And so, you know, it's important to make sure that we have the right framework to help you compete, because it's a very, very noisy world. It's difficult to get people to pay attention. And so it's important then to stand out in the way that Apple, as an example, or as Tesla or as Virgin or others have been able to do and do successfully.
So what do you do as a designer if you're thinking there has to be a sense of an aspirational buy here when you reach for an Apple Watch or an Apple product? I mean, you say in your book all design is contextual, but when you're designing with the goal of, you know, an aspirational product in mind, for example, just that quality, what comes to mind, you know, for you?
It goes back to, you know, what is it that you want people to know about you? Mm. If you think about whether it's retail or any other business, you're ultimately defining a relationship and a structure for the relationship. If you have a good relationship, whether it's B2B, B2C, whatever it may be, you have to pay attention to the value of that relationship. And so one of the key things that we always look at are we communicating what we stand for initially so that we can attract people? And we basically look at a sequence of, you know, attracting, engaging, and connecting with people. And ultimately that's the process that's used in relationship development. And so my co-author, Roger Lehman, who's a professor at INSEAD in Singapore, part of the thread through the book is him identifying why some of the things that we're doing work at a psychological level. And so it's important for us to continue to think about the things that we're creating, not just from a look and feel, but what it does for people in terms of the outcomes.
In terms of the planning board, how do you know if a design is going to lead to customers loving a company?
I don't think you really ever know. Mm-hmm. You know, the night before we opened the first Apple store, we had set everything and the lights were perfect and everything was ready to go. And Steve was sitting on one of the tables and we all sort of went over to him and said, okay, you know, here we go. And he looked at us and he said, guys, what if nobody comes tomorrow? And we were all sort of dumbfounded at that point because we had just spent, you know, 2 years building this concept and the store. And the reality was nobody was sure that, you know, that people were going to be attracted, that people were going to want to be part of this. Now, in the morning, we had 4,000 people waiting in line. And, you know, people had flown from all over the world. People had come from Europe and all over. And it was a crazy madhouse. There's actually a great little film on it. But, you know, that notion of, you know, Steve, you know, of anyone who should have been, you know, confident that it would have been a success, he would have been the one. Mm. And he still, you know, had his doubts. And I think it goes back to the courage to take some risk. I mean, it's hard to imagine today Apple without the retail program, actually. It's hard to even, you know, imagine what that would be like as a brand. But at that time, we were probably, whether we were breaking rules or whether we were just, you know, in uncharted territory, I think we were definitely taking risks. And, you know, one of the things we talk about with our clients these days that we work with, and we're still working with Apple, it's our 23rd year with them, but you know, we still talk about risk, and, you know, at a time where everything is changing so incredibly fast and getting faster, the real risk is probably, you know, staying pat. That you know, following status quo is probably the most dangerous thing you can do because everything is changing so quickly around you. So we're always encouraging clients to lay out a framework of what you know they believe is a successful strategy because it delivers on human outcomes. And typically, when you do that, you create value. If you create value, you probably will survive as a business. But if you're just extracting value from the company you have, and you're in a value extraction kind of business, that might change overnight. It might happen to you so quickly that you don't have a chance to recover. So, you know, we work with companies to help form strategies going forward. We worked with Citibank outlining, you know, what happens next year, what happens in the next 5 years for them that would cause their company to disappear. And so we look at these different contingencies as well as shape what is the best possible experience going forward.
This is Your Money. We are speaking with legendary designer Tim Kobe. I love his book, Return on Experience. It's on bookshelves here in Singapore, a book that really reflects deeply on the role of design. So, Tim, retail we know is changing. A whole generation of digital shoppers have grown up with screens as their interface. Mm. What does this mean for designing for retail?
Well, you know, retail among many other businesses are probably experiencing the greatest shift in their business model that they ever have. But the idea that particularly with younger generation, they're growing up with mobile devices, you know, as a as a normal or standard condition. So, you know, everybody, say millennial and older, we all remember a world that was a pre-iPhone and a post-iPhone world. You know, we appreciate and understand the kind of impact we've been through. The younger generations, it's like oxygen. They only care if they don't have it. So the tech isn't as impressive in a way. It just has to be fundamentally there, ubiquitous, and basically the interface that they have to work with any brand, any company, any individual. So it means, I think, changing your perspective on how you become relevant in that conversation. And certainly with retail, the distribution models, as well as the experience that people have in you know, going through purchase flows and things like that, those are all being transformed by the influence of technology. COVID, as we know, accelerated all of this, and so getting people to adopt at a much faster rate, that has already been taken care of with COVID. And so I think what you find is the companies who haven't formed a digital strategy that allows all of their touch points that they offer their customers to become more integrated and more seamless, those are the ones who are going to struggle to keep up with the ones who have already, you know, taken that new position.
For example, Alibaba's HEMA store features quite a number of experimental ideas linking technology to an in-store experience. And HEMA stores actually double as warehouses for online purchases, which the employees fulfill. So do physical stores have to take on new roles to keep customers coming in?
Yeah, exactly. I think they play a different role in the supply chain. I think there are some other companies who are looking at other models for retail distribution. And I think what is important is we recognize that there's everything from a pure digital piece to a pure human to human interaction, but there's a number of different points along that spectrum that will be relevant to what the customer needs and wants at a particular time. And it's somewhat product dependent. It's somewhat based on their particular mode that they're in terms of consuming products, etc. We've done a fair amount of work in China, have had great successes there. We worked with Xiaomi, for example, in helping them integrate both physical and digital touch points into their retail offer. We've done work with Nike on their global program. They're a big proponent of integration of physical and digital space. So we see this hybrid being being tested in many different ways, but ultimately, it requires a sensitivity to both of them simultaneously, as opposed to the old days when it was either, you know, bricks and mortar versus digital or something. That polarity, I think, has gone away.
So, do you, direct to consumer, is that at all affecting how you design retail?
Sure. I think, you know, the direct to consumer conversation is important for a number of reasons. The first is obviously ubiquitous access. So it no longer means I have to be in a specific site in order to engage. It means that also we have an opportunity for a dialogue. And it doesn't mean just broadcasting ads, but it means, you know, being able to have a truly meaningful understanding of what the customers need. Xiaomi, who I mentioned in China, they have a group of Mi fans, they're called. Mi fans, they have 50 million people who, whenever Xiaomi gets ready to launch a product, they put it into their Mi fan base, a series of renderings and drawings and videos and stuff. And they basically have a 50 million person focus group tell them whether or not it's right or they've missed some detail or what have you. So they know before they spend a penny on tooling whether or not the product is going to be a success.
Wow.
And so the leverage of that capability, you know, it's similar to, you know, when you do a Google search, Google gets smarter. It's a very, very strong competitive advantage that many companies who don't leverage those assets have are going to struggle with.
Tim, your book is called Return on Experience. As you mentioned, you work with Xiaomi. Many brands here in the East, you've worked with brands from all around the world, from West to East. Do you see a difference in terms of Eastern or Western approaches to design in terms of an understanding of customer experience?
I don't know if I would say in terms of understanding the customer experience. It varies globally. There are those in different markets who really do have a high level of sophistication and understanding, and there are those in the same markets who really don't. And so I don't think it's based on a geographic distribution. I think it's much more about how the leadership of a company understands the world they're in and how they think about how to best respond to building those relationships that I talked about earlier.
Would you say East or West, you know, is any side more in tune with the need to change quickly, with the pace of change required in terms of reaching their customers and detailing a store to customer experience? I think the cliche is that in China, everything is tech-driven and they're really winning the tech race, so to speak. Did you get that sense when you worked in China?
Yeah, I would say not only in China, but basically in Asia in general. I would say that, you know, what's interesting is that the development of the technology in the U.S., for example, we had Ethernet lines. We were wired to the wall. But in China and much of Asia, the ubiquitous access to technology came through a mobile device. And that untethering has led to, I think, a much faster adoption. It's led to a more diverse way of thinking about how technology informs client relationship. Mm-hmm. So what I've seen in the U.S. with some companies is that they lag substantially because they're still thinking about being tied to a desktop, which of course is almost laughable at this stage. But, you know, that idea that the real growth in the technology came through mobile devices means that mobility is a big portion of what the technology is enabling. And so that's a little bit different, set of benchmarks for designing the experience. So from that perspective, I would say it's certainly true in China. China has moved so quickly to adopt a lot of these things. It's remarkable how quickly they went from being able to pay with a taxi in cash to not being able to pay for a taxi with cash. So, you know, it's It really is moving at an incredible pace. I would say, and I think it's right because of the age demographics and distribution and the technology evolution. Those all of those things influence the different parts of the world that are able to see where that next step is.
It's a fascinating conversation. Before we let you go, I know you're joining us in San Francisco, but you do have a presence here, 8 Inc., here in Singapore. That's important for Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of the projects that you're working on?
Sure. I'm actually a PR in Singapore. I happen to be in San Francisco because I travel our different offices. We have 11 offices. I travel those once a year typically to check in with the different teams, and I happen to be here in San Francisco.
Oh, good. So we'll welcome you back soon. That's good.
Yeah. No, I'll be back. I'll be back as soon as the quarantine is over. We have been able to work with some great clients in Singapore. Obviously, Singtel has been one of our clients. We did their innovations lab. Singapore Repertory Theater, Temasek. We've worked with a number of groups in different sectors as well. So Como Hotels. We have basically for my Asia region, I've made Singapore the headquarters. So that's one of the reasons I moved there. As I'm sure everyone in Singapore knows, you go 8 hours on an airplane on any radius, and you cover probably 5 billion of the 7 billion people on the planet. So
yeah.
We have great reach, great access. The majority of people are under 30 years old, means this is where the economy is, for at least the next 30 years.
Well, glad to know you call Singapore home as well, Tim. Thanks for the conversation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining
us. I appreciate the call.
Thanks. Tim Kobe, founder and CEO of 8 Inc. He's got a great book out. It's called Return on Experience. I'm Michelle Martin. Thanks for joining me.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.